My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with David Mitchell. David, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thank you very much.
Have you been here before? Did you come here for Cloud Atlas?
Yes, I did. I was here 2004, I think.
Cloud Atlas.
It's a great city.
It's a nice place, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. If I lived anywhere in the States, then it would be here, please.
Please come.
Well, there's a nice house for sale across the road, actually. If you can have a word in high places with me.
I have no words in high places. I don't even have high words in places anymore. So let me read a little bit about you so people know who you are. You were born in Southport, Merseyside, not far from Liverpool, I presume.
Yep.
Lived for a year in Sicily. That's interesting. Then moved to Hiroshima. Am I saying that close to being?
Perfect.
Thank you. In Japan, where you taught English to technical students for 8 years. Imagine the colloquies outside of the technical area were a lot more rewarding than teaching people how to say LAN in Japanese.
I enjoyed teaching as well.
Okay.
Yeah. I learned a lot from my students.
Absolutely. You did that before returning to England, then another stint in Japan, and now you live in Ireland. Good writer place, like Portland. Not dissimilar weather either,
yeah,
frankly.
Sure. Very green. Very green.
Very green. Very green. At the Emerald Isle, I believe. Here's a quote from you. I knew I wanted to be a writer since I was a kid, but until I came to Japan to live in 1994, I was too easily distracted to do much about it. I know exactly what you're talking about. Your first novel, Ghostwritten, in 99, moves around the globe from Okinawa to Mongolia to premillennial New York City, and has 9 narrators. You like to do that, don't you, to create different stories for different people? Yeah. Subsequently, there was Number 9 Dream and Cloud Atlas, which was a wonderful book, by the way.
Thank you.
Which were shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. You're doing okay, as writers go, aren't you? Though your current book, of course, is The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. And we were talking before I started recording, and I've been reading nothing but high praise. The only review I've read that did not actually throw itself at your feet had a couple of reservations about your story construction because they were desperately trying to find something they didn't like about your book.
Obviously, I'm gratified when people like what I do, when people make a positive connection with it. Every writer wants that. At the same time, once you start believing it, I think that's the start of the slippery slope to professional incompetence. That's a sort of the first step down the road to that mysterious novelist's graveyard where a lot of people must go, because there are many more people publishing books in their 30s than there are active novelists still writing really relevant stuff in their 60s.
Well, some of it, I think, is just egomania. If you're secure inside yourself enough so that you don't need the constant praise of human beings you don't even know, you know, like God, for example, then you're doing okay. I don't know if I mentioned that the book is published by Random House, and Jacob de Zoet. De Zoet is spelled D-E-Z-O-E-T, and you're David Mitchell. That's spelled like David Mitchell.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right. Dejima?
Fine.
Okay, Dejima and Nagasaki. Nagasaki everybody knows about, but nobody knows about Dejima. Your book takes place at the turn of the 19th century, 1799, 1800. What the heck was going on in those days? What was Dejima? What was its purpose, and why was it there?
It was a trading post run by the Dutch East Indies Company. It was the one place in the whole of Japan for almost 2.5 centuries where outsiders, foreigners, Europeans specifically, were allowed to live and work. It looked physically small island, a man-made artificial island, just about a third of an acre in size, one street, few warehouses, that was it. In Nagasaki Harbour, it was located, connected to the mainland by a short bridge that a horse could have jumped over, so very small in scale. But big, so I thought, in novelistic potential. Unlike other trading posts in the East, the Europeans there didn't rule the roost or have the opportunity to quietly turn it into an empire. They weren't allowed off it, for one thing, and the only 3 types of people allowed on it were translators, who passed down their knowledge of Dutch, as Japanese translators, of course, who passed down their knowledge of Dutch from father to son, and merchants who were there for the at 3 months of the year when the ship that came from Batavia, modern-day Jakarta, which was the hub of Dutch operations in the east, was in harbour. Rest of the 9 months, no ship, no merchants. And lastly, very, very expensive prostitutes. No one else was allowed on. So there's a lot of confinement, high walls. And walls, again, are good news for novelists because the full gamut of human emotions is... has nowhere to go, and it will bloom and bear its fruit.
Why does Dubai suddenly pop into my head? I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
What was interesting to me, now, in those unenlightened times, before people knew about political correctness and the proper names to call people, the Dutch, who in those days were a big world power, I mean, now you think of Dutch as this quaint little country in Europe that's under,
got to the final of the World Cup.
Yes, yeah, that's right. But you think of them as for dikes and dams and good weed, I suppose, is
I suppose they'd be the top three.
Yes. That's why do people go to Amsterdam to see the house where Anne Frank lived? Maybe. But what do they do when they leave there? They go to a coffee shop and get loaded. But in those days, the Dutch were a world power. They were a naval power. They were a trading power. And they had the exclusive right to trade with Japan. Tell us how that came about.
They did. That was for historical reasons. Up until, I'm going to be a bit cautious on my dates because I know you have a very erudite audience. Up until I think about 1630s, 1640s, Japan was something of a free market. Anyone who could go there and trade, able to. Spanish, Portuguese, English, and the Dutch were there. However, the Portuguese and Spanish also wanted to proselytize. So there were Jesuit missionaries and Franciscan missionaries there, converting large numbers of Japanese people to Christianity. All well and good, up until the Shimabara Rebellion, which was really a peasant uprising, but it soon... acquired the trappings of a Christian revolt, they won for a while, to Edo's horror, Edo, modern day Tokyo, of course. And from then on, the Tokugawa shogunate, which was the dynasty that controlled the country for 2.5 centuries, again slightly longer, realised that to stay on top of the pile, they had to keep out the agents of change. No Christianity, and that quite quickly turned into, we don't really want these foreigners running around our country, do we? Mm-hmm. So up went the walls, the doors shut, but just one. The Dutch proved their loyalty to the authorities. They lent a ship to go around the coast. Shimabara isn't actually far from Nagasaki, and actually bombarded the castle where the rebels were holding out. Please, sir, we're not like the other boys. You can let us stay.
Wow.
The English were allowed to stay as well, but they couldn't make it pay. They spent all the money on prostitutes. but the Dutch are better businessmen, and they stayed, and that's why they were allowed. But they were confined on Dejima just to make sure that. For the whole of that long 2.5 century interregnum in Nagasaki and its environs, every year, every Japanese person had to stamp on a bronze image of Christ to prove that they weren't Christians.
Fumie?
Yeah, that's correct.
I'd never heard of that until I wrote about it in your book. I just have to say in passing that this was mutual. The Japanese thought of the Europeans as uncouth slobs, mm-hmm. and the Europeans mm-hmm. thought of the Japanese as ignorant savages. Mm-hmm. Of course, neither of which was true. And yet that sort of prejudice is what was what prevailed in those days.
Well, as the saying goes, we don't often... human beings aren't overly gifted at seeing things as they are. We tend to see things as we are. That's why we have stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's why we have xenophobia.
Yeah. Tell us about Fumie. I found that fascinating.
Fumi is to tread, e is picture. As I said, you had to prove that you weren't a Christian. What really fascinates me is it didn't actually work. And for 2.5 centuries, there were secretive cults of hidden Christians, they called themselves, who still believed in the Gospels. They didn't have any texts. When the last Franciscan missionaries were being kicked out, it would seem that the Japanese Christians who refused to convert in secret, if you didn't apostatize in public, then you were crucified. That was the end of you. But the Franciscan monks told their flock that if they could keep the faith for 9 generations, then that's it. Their descendants would have a permanent passport into heaven. And this was remembered, and it went on for more than 9 generations. And, of course, the religious message, sort of, that the myths conflated and the Christian stories drifted, shall we say. But in the 1860s, when the Western powers rather bullied Japan into declaring freedom of religion, to everyone's astonishment, out of nowhere came some 20,000-30,000 Japanese Christians saying, "We are Christian, and we always have been." So the Fumie wasn't actually completely fit for purpose.
Yeah, it was just a show, you know. Well, the thing that interests me about that is those who do not know the lessons of history are bound to repeat them. The original Christians had the same problem with Rome. And they went underground, and they thrived underground, and they hid from the authorities, and they wound up taking over the world pretty much. So the Japanese did not know that story, and therefore knew that they couldn't suppress Christianity just by suppressing it.
They couldn't eradicate it altogether. They did stop it threatening the power structure of their state.
That was
technically, ideologically, they failed, but politically and sociologically, they succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Jacob de Zoet. He's a young man who comes from Holland to work in Japan at Dejima. He's a clerk, but he's also very ambitious. He's a smart guy. One of the things he brings with him is a lot of mercury, a mercuric compound, which was used in those days to treat, was it gonorrhea, syphilis, something like that, both.
An array of venereal diseases, which weren't terribly well understood, and no one's quite, it probably didn't work, but it's the nature of gonorrhea to come and go of its own accord. But a crucial thing is that mercury was believed in. Mm-hmm. And the mercury cure was believed in, and it was used in Europe and probably North America as well.
And might have killed Mozart, actually.
Yeah.
So he figures he has a girlfriend back in Holland.
A fiancé. It would be in the end of the 18th century.
Yes,
they did girlfriends then. But yeah, go on.
Yeah. Well, I suppose one could be seeing someone prior to being, but they're actually engaged. And his idea is to stay there a few years, to make a killing with the mercury, to learn something, and to come back with a small fortune, which he would then use to further himself in Holland and marry his girlfriend.
And get the girl. Get that fiancé.
The fiancé, pardon me. Yeah. There I go again, yeah. He's a nice guy. He's a nice man. He has a certain amount of personal integrity, a lot of personal integrity. One of the things he's there to do is to, somebody's been cooking the books for the Dutch East India Company, and he's there to check out the books to find out what's going on. Tell us about that.
Probably Dejima didn't make the company any money. I think it existed for such a long time because it made the individuals who were able to skim off the top, to skim the cream off, to skim the cream and the milk and just about everything with the bottom inch in the bottom of the pail for themselves. Jacob's patron has got himself appointed the chief resident of Dejima. His name is Forstenbosch. He's got himself appointed as a kind of a troubleshooter, and I'll go in and stamp out the corruption. He, of course, has an agenda of his own. Jacob uniquely hasn't. He's an honest man in a nest of vipers. And if you really want to get yourself in trouble, then be honest in that context. And that's what happens to him. He finds much more trouble than he imagined he would. I wanted to make him uncool. It's easy to write a cool character who... something of a rogue, someone we can identify with, but to try and make him slightly prudish, rather pious, and somewhat uncool, that makes him more interesting for me, a more interesting challenge to try to write.
I'd like to remind our listeners I'm speaking with David Mitchell. David is the author of The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. You can tell us what that means in a minute. And it's published by Random House. But you know, you didn't make him uncool. That's the whole thing. I find him to be an admirable guy. I find him to be somewhat daring because he has smuggled a Christian book, a Psalter, into the... Dejima, which is not a good idea.
No.
In fact, the customs has nothing on these guys who are searching for Christian texts on all the Europeans who come in. He seemed to me to be, if not cool, at least a lot of personal integrity and some courage.
Then maybe uncool is the new cool, Ed.
Black is the new black, yeah.
It's the one rule he can't obey because of the Japanese fear of Christianity and loathing of Christianity that we've already discussed. All the foreigners landing on Dejima, even all the foreigners on the ship that just sat there in the harbour in quarantine, apart from the trading vessels that bring the goods ashore, they had to hand over their Christian artefacts, their crucifixes, their St. Christopher's, their Bibles, their prayer books, and in Jacob's case, he was supposed to hand over his Psalter, a book of Psalms, which has been in the family for generations, and he can't. He feels that would be like him stamping on a bronze image of Christ. He can't do it.
Well, it's also a lucky item. This is something that has helped literally save lives in his family.
Yeah, indeed. And in a superstitious age, sort of handing over a crucifix as well for a sailor sort of might be like renouncing your life insurance policy or health insurance for us now, maybe. Yeah. So, yes, he does smuggle this book ashore. It's kind of a device as well. The day he goes ashore, I have to broadband a lot of information at the reader, lots of Dutch and Japanese names, and I wanted a strong subplot during that chapter to get the reader through.
Well, speaking of subplots, there's a major parallel plot going on here that I haven't even mentioned yet. I haven't mentioned Abagawa Orito. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
That's fine.
Yeah. It's the accent usually on the first syllable in Japanese.
In Japanese, it is on non, so it would be Aibagawa Orito.
This all unstressed syllables.
All unstressed, the whole language, except one or two rare occasions where there are homonyms. But yep, it's an unstressed language. Sometimes rather a stressed out place, but it's an unstressed language.
Okay, Ella, you may have that pun. she's
I have more in store,
and we can't wait. She's a midwife, but she's not just a midwife. She is like the King Kong midwife that anybody has ever heard of in this area. She has done stuff that people think she has magic powers.
Yeah. Well, almost every woman in literature of this type and from this time and in Nagasaki is geisha. And my wife happens to be Japanese, and she warned me that if I wrote yet another geisha who just swoons at the feet of a tall blonde Westerner saying, "Oh, you're so tall, blonde and Western," then I can't actually say on live radio what she threatened to do to me, but it wasn't pretty.
Did it involve a tanto knife?
Yes.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
She couldn't be a geisha, and I wanted to avoid that for cliche reasons. So who could she be? One more group of Japanese people occasionally allowed onto Dejima were medical students. You see, to the Japanese, Dejima wasn't just about money, it was about knowledge. It was a window onto the world through which they could see what was happening in the rest of the world, and actually of great importance to 19th century Japanese history, what was happening to non-white cultures who were getting too far technologically behind European powers. So it was also about knowledge and the Enlightenment texts, medical texts, technological tracts, metallurgy, whole new sciences actually, economics. They were filtering into Japan through Dejima around the end of the 18th century, medicine in particular. And
was this the only window into Japan, literally, that island?
Literally.
Yeah.
There was a Chinese trading concession there as well, and some texts would have got in through that, but first it had to be translated into Chinese, and then, nothing else. It was illegal for anyone to land anywhere, and the best you could hope was to be booted off, and to plan to leave Japan for Japanese people at that time was a capital offence. The midwife, medical students were allowed on occasionally to study under the surgeon, who was one of the year-round staff, and I thought maybe, just maybe, a woman could be one of those if she'd provided a unique service to the most powerful man in Nagasaki, the magistrate. What kind of a service? Probably not the obvious sexual one. That wouldn't do it. Suppose she manages to save his heir in childbirth during an impossible childbirth when all the smart money doesn't want to go near there because they don't want to be associated with this obvious infant mortality. What happens is that there's a prolapse of the arm and the child's arm comes out first. Ordinarily in those times that's a death sentence for the kid. And probably the mother as well. But she's seen these texts just at this point at the end of the 18th century. Two Scottish doctors, Smiley and Hunter, were founding what is now what we now call obstetrics. And the first texts had gone into Japan. She's seen them. They were illustrated with really quite shocking engravings, but she's seen them and she knows where to put her hand. She knows what to do. She delivers a child. This earns her the favour of being allowed onto Dejima. Phew. I then have the question, why isn't she married by this point? And I kind of answer that by having her burned down one side of the face by a girlhood accident. So just trying to make her not be a geisha, that actually gives me the plot for the first third of the book. Mm-hmm. So sometimes straitjackets can be your friend.
Now, there are a number of characters in this book, and it's almost a lost cause to go through everyone and what they do. But Dr. Marinus has to be one we have to talk about. In fact, Orito is his student.
Yeah.
And she is learning what passes for Western medicine in those days, which still included bleeding, among other things. It wasn't exactly ER. So
not exactly. No. And he's not exactly George Clooney.
Yeah, that's right. He's a character. You give us a couple of minutes on Marinus, because we've been talking quite a while, but we really have to hear about him.
Marinus is kind of my favorite man in the book, really.
I sort of knew that.
He's probably only number five or six in terms of numbers of lines, but when he's around he tends to steal the show. He's one of these ancient souls you meet sometimes and you get the feeling that really they're 2,000 years old and not 60 years old. Technically he's a disciple of Linnaeus, the great organizer of the natural world from Uppsala, or who was teaching at Uppsala in Sweden.
Did he invent phylums and species and genera and just stuff so, like that? So,
yeah. And we still use the binom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Ah, it's embarrassing on the radio. Binominal, I think it is.
Close enough.
System of categorizing plants and animals, yeah. It was a great Enlightenment project to go forth and find all these unknown creatures all over the world and plants and categorize them. Same was done even with...
He's also plants. A relentless cynic, and he functions as an advisor who always tells Jacob the worst thing that could possibly happen. I think preparing him for the worst thing that could possibly happen. I can't imagine why else he would do that.
Yeah, he does. And he's also quite hard to pin down. Just when you've decided he's an incurable cynic, he proves himself to be something. Well, he shows he might have a soft romantic streak as well. And when you've decided that's the case, he does something else, which makes you think that he's got a militaristic streak almost. So he's something of a chameleon, which makes him interesting to work with and write.
About a minute. How much research is doing? This is an enormous amount of historical information here, and I presume some of the things you've put in the book are fictional, but the amount of actual research in here is staggering. And rather than the research being tacked on so that you know that it's research, you've managed to integrate it into the book so that it just seems like the story. How hard did you work on the research in this book?
Well, thank you for the kind thing you say about my writing in that question. Lots would be the short answer. Hard to know really where research stops and writing starts sometimes.
Could you have done it without your time in Japan?
No. I wouldn't have encountered Japan without my time in the... I wouldn't have encountered Dejima without my time in Japan, so the book wouldn't exist. There's hardcore research, archives, interviewing academics, assembling the girders and the scaffold of the story. Then there's sort of softer core research where you're writing a scene and Jacob's shaving the mirror. Did shaving foam exist in 1799? You have to go away, find out when it was invented. Would it have been affordable to a clerk in the Dutch East Indies Company at that time, if it did exist then, just to finish a sentence? So, you never really stop researching until you've finished the last sentence of the book, really. And then, as you say, you have to hide it, because nothing's worse than
obvious research.
Obvious research,
yeah. Somebody once said, if I see research in a book, I throw it across the room. So it's not in this book. This is a general question, and it has to be asked relatively quickly, unfortunately. There once was a man named Lafcadio Hearn, and the Japanese used to say that he was the only Westerner who ever truly absorbed Japanese culture. Japanese culture is really enigmatic to the average Westerner, mostly because of lack of knowledge, ignorance. But you having lived there, when you left Japan, had the enigma lifted at all for you, or did it just seem more enigmatic than ever?
Again, a short answer. I would say the enigma has lifted. And you hear this a lot about Japan. It is a different culture. It is different. It might even be differently different, as a friend describes Japan. But 125 million people there most certainly understand it. And
they live it every day.
They do. And I think this sort of lost in translation style Japan, it's something that really everyone buys into a little bit more than they need to. It's a modern manifestation of the inscrutable Oriental, really. Mm-hmm. It's politically incorrect to use that on people, so we sort of use it about the whole country. No, human beings are pretty universal creatures. How we express our needs and desires may be different. How we construct a society to deliver them may be different, but it's not as mysterious as everyone likes to make out, I think.
Certainly betrayal, corruption, and greed are lavished upon all sides in this, no matter what. I think probably Jacob is the only one who's not actually corrupt and greedy, maybe Orito as well. There are a couple of people who behave nicely, but they have their own agendas as well. So, It's really been delightful talking to you.
Oh, you too. Thank you.
This is David Mitchell's book, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. I never asked you what that meant, but we don't have time now. Published by Random House. Let people buy the book. It's explained in here.
It is.
Thanks for coming, and come back again.
My pleasure. Until next time.